Radio.
Death Talk, a talk by Professor Margaret Somerville for the Institute for Ethics and Society at the University of Notre Dame, Australia.
Thank you. And it's very nice to be here, and I'm surprised by how many people come out at this time of the day. So, death talk. First, I thought I'd better explain to you what I mean by death talk. I have a theory, although it's not proven by any means, that we have to engage in a certain amount of conversation with each other about death in order to accommodate the reality of death into the living of our lives if we're to live reasonably comfortably. And what I think has happened is that in the past we had a given place and a given time and we did our death talk there and then we went on with our lives for the rest of the week. And that time and place was when you went to the synagogue or the cathedral or the mosque or the prayer house, and you listened to the talk about death and you accommodated it through your belief in religion. But what we've got now is a great number of people in our secular Western democracies who do not participate in any organized religious fashion, although what the studies show are that people are, they describe themselves as spiritual but not religious. So I think that they still have those instincts, but they're not acted out in the same way. And I think that the euthanasia debate might be a leaking out into society in general of a search for a way to accommodate death, and the way that that's being done is to try to take as much control of death as we can. And that makes sense because there's a group of psychologists who study the psyche of societies. And they talk about a very intense, free-floating fear and how you have to somehow try and get control of that fear. And so one way that you could describe what's going on in these euthanasia debates, I mean, surely it can't be an accident that they're erupting in all our Western democracies. And they would describe it as a terror reduction mechanism or a terror management device. Now, when they first started to talk about this, we weren't faced with the current concerns over terrorism. They just simply meant terror in its ordinary basic sense, and that we have this terror of death and we have to have mechanisms, or we develop mechanisms to control it. So I think that it's probably helpful to see the euthanasia debate through that lens. There's a lot of other lenses that we need to see it through as well. But because if that's what is happening, then if we want to not have euthanasia, we have to understand that and see what we can do to give some other means that this can be managed other than through euthanasia. So what I want to do is make the case, what I'm suggesting is that to make the case against euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, and although those are different, for my purposes, they can be dealt with as one, and I use the word euthanasia. So we have to understand why the case for it is being made, which is what I just told you, and how that case is being made. What are the arguments that are being put forward, and what are the responses to those arguments? So first of all, I want to start off with a general observation, and that is that mainstream media, certainly in Canada, and I'm not so sure in Australia, but my guess would be they are very strongly pro-euthanasia. And we have just had a new judgment in Canada of the Supreme Court of Canada, in which they struck down the provisions in the criminal code that prohibited assisted suicide or even the prohibition on murder to the extent that it prohibited euthanasia. And the court as a body, and my legal colleagues here, I have some of my classmates from 35 years ago are actually in the audience tonight, so they will understand that when the court, and it rarely does this, speaks not as individual judges, but as the court, they're meaning to emphasize how strongly they believe this is the right judgment. And the court struck down those provisions, and therefore they gave the Canadian government 12 months to draft legislation that would allow physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. And what I want to show you now is that this is the front page, page one of the Globe and Mail, which is the national newspaper in Canada, the morning after the judgment was released on the Friday morning. And what it says is a step toward kindness, which is a very, and the Globe and Mail is very pro-euthanasia. And this is what what it says in that, the writing on the picture is, it was a day of bittersweet triumph for supporters of assisted suicide, as the Supreme Court's unanimous decision means new choices for terminally ill Canadians and tough questions for families, physicians and politicians across the country. Now that word choice is not an accident. Choice, autonomy, a certain concept of dignity, although I very much agree with the Dean of Law that concept has been manipulated so that it really means the opposite of what it was originally intended to mean. But those are very important words in this debate. So now what I want to do with you, very superficially, because I've written a lot about this stuff, that book, Death Talk, is 455 pages long. And so, you know, sometimes it's hard to know what are the best points to make when you've got very limited time to do it. But what I want to point out to you first are the strategies that are being used by the pro-euthanasia people, because I think once you understand the strategies, then you can think about ways to negate them. But if you don't understand them, then you can't. So this is one that I only came across a few weeks ago, and it was as a result of being present at a big named lecture which McGill put on as a debate. It's an annual lecture, quite famous. And what they did was they had the young woman politician who shepherded an act through the Quebec Parliament, which is purporting to legalize euthanasia, which raises a whole heap of questions about constitutional law because it's not even clear they've got the power to do it. But they've done it. And they said, well, if it's not legally valid, we will tell doctors that they can do euthanasia, and we won't prosecute them. And whether or not you launch a prosecution is actually a provincial jurisdiction, so they would be allowing people to commit murder and then not prosecuting them for doing it. And one of the things I realized in listening to her debating the person who was saying, no, we shouldn't have euthanasia, was that one of the pro-euthanasia strategies is to start by saying, look, we all agree about 99% of this. We all agree people should have a right to good palliative care. We all agree people have got the right to refuse treatment. We all agree that people should have fully adequate pain management. So it's just a tiny little bit that we don't agree on. So why do we concentrate on that? Why don't we just let people do what they want to do? And it all sounds nice, and you know, if it was a pussycat, it'd be purring. And so, you know, and I listened to this and I thought, gosh, you know, I've actually promoted the idea that we should, when we disagree about values issues, that we should try and start from where we agree, because that gives a different tone to the debate. We realise that we've got some commonality, that we all belong at one point to the same moral community. And so, you know, normally I'd say, that's good, that's exactly what we should do. But I don't think we should do it in euthanasia from what I've seen. I think we have to say, no, this is not a debate about end of life. We all agree and we can put all that aside. This is a debate that must be focused on, and I get into terrible trouble for saying this in Canada, we have to focus on whether we want doctors to kill their patients. And people get very upset, they don't like that word kill, but I think it's a word that we have to use and we have to take the flak for using it. So that's the first strategy. The second strategy, and this was the one that was used in the Supreme Court case, is to focus on a suffering individual person who wants euthanasia, redefining the right to life, advocating the right to choose, and emphasizing the cruelty of denial to somebody who's dying who wants this. I was once, in 1993, I was debating a woman called Sue Rodriguez, who had Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And she said to me on television, she said, how can you be so cruel that you would deny me this, even the person who's going to be executed in places where there's still capital punishment, are given their last wish, but you're refusing that to me. And so there's this strong emphasis that denying euthanasia is cruel. Now, what the Supreme Court said was this. This is the opening paragraph of the Supreme Court decision. They said it's a crime in Canada to assist another person ending her own life. As a result, people who are grievously and irremediably ill cannot seek a physician's assistance in dying and may be condemned to a life of severe and intolerable suffering. A person facing this prospect has two options. She can take her own life prematurely, often by violent or dangerous means, or she can suffer until she dies from natural causes. And this is the key phrase in the judgment, in the whole judgment. The choice is cruel. In other words, denying euthanasia is cruel. So it's converting kindness to killing. That's what's happening in the judgment. Those four words, the choice is cruel, tell us what the Supreme Court will decide. Now, what the Supreme Court of Canada did, they looked at the right to life. And when I first, they took this from the trial court judgment. It was not their original invention. But when I first saw it in the trial court, I couldn't believe it. In the Canadian Constitution, every individual has a right to life, liberty, and security of the person. And so the court looked at all those three rights, and it held that they were all unjustifiably breached by a prohibition on assisted suicide and euthanasia. Now, it's hard to see how prohibiting killing somebody could be a breach of the right to life. But this is what the court held. It said the right to life is not a duty to live. And they pointed out that we let people refuse treatment like a ventilator so that they die earlier. And then they said that prohibiting assisted suicide shortens life because the person has to commit suicide earlier while they're still able to do it. And therefore, if you legalized assisted suicide, they could wait knowing that someone would either give them a lethal injection or help them to kill themselves at a later time. And therefore, that was a breach of the right to life to prohibit that assistance because it meant that that the person would die earlier through committing suicide earlier. So what they've done in effect is to convert the right to life to a right to death, to a right to be killed or to have help in killing yourself. The other thing that the court did, and I think this is very important, although there was evidence from individual cases brought at the trial court, both for people who wanted euthanasia, and in fact the plaintiffs were people who wanted euthanasia legalised, in defence, the Attorney General of Canada was defending the Canadian law, and I was on that side and having a bit of a finger in the pie about how we were going to do this. We also brought evidence of people who said, you know, I would have been killed, but, you know, then I got good palliative care and I'm still alive and it's so long since, you know, I've enjoyed this time and I've seen my grandkids and whatever else it might be. But the trial court didn't put any of the individual stories about people who were glad they hadn't been killed, and it put in lots of horrible stories about people who said they'd had suffering that they wish they could have avoided. So I think that's something else that you've got to take into account, that how can you rebalance those stories? And the pro-euthanasia advocates in Canada had some very powerful short television films, and they put them on the television, and one of them was of a Dr. Donald Lowe, who had become a Canadian hero. He was the main public health physician in Ontario, and when Ontario had one of the worst SARS epidemics in the world, and indeed 43 healthcare professionals died of SARS in Ontario, this man was in charge of trying to control this epidemic, and he did an amazing job at great risk to himself and looking after patients. Well, last year he got a brain tumor, and his wife is a television producer with CBC, and they produced a film of him begging for euthanasia. And of course, he's a Canadian hero, and this was enormously powerful. And he looked terrible, and he said, you know, all I wish is that everybody could have to live for 5 minutes in my body, and they would approve of this. So what we have to do is we've got to listen to the people who want it. We have to take into account their stories, but we've got to think of ways that we can also counteract some of those stories, not to ignore them or dismiss them, but to show that there's more to this debate than just this intense individualism. The strongest case for euthanasia is at the level of the suffering, articulate, respected individual who says, it is total cruelty to deny me this. And that's what we've got to deal with. Now, strategy three is the no difference argument. And there were numerous examples of this in the case in Canada. What this is that the pro-euthanasia people that argue that we all agree that people can refuse life support treatment, we all agree people have got a right to fully adequate pain management, even if that could shorten life, which of course everybody who knows anything about pain management knows that that's a highly unlikely circumstance. And indeed, the latest research shows good pain management probably prolongs life if it does anything. But they say, well, we do that, and those things are, euthanasia is no different. It's just a tiny further step along that same pathway, and that those things are regarded as ethical and legal, therefore euthanasia is ethical and legal. So what they're really arguing is it's just a small incremental change, and there's no need to get upset about it. Now, the argument against that, and it's the one that I accept, is that legalising euthanasia represents a seismic shift in one of our most fundamental societal values, namely respect for life. And that humans, for thousands of years and in all kinds of societies, we have said we must not kill each other, intentionally kill each other. The only exceptions are where that is the only way to save innocent human life, and that's the rationale, for example, for self-defense, it's the rationale for so-called just war, etc. And so I think that we have to be very careful to address this no difference argument. And I think the basis for addressing it is to say that there is a difference in intention when you're giving pain management treatment as compared with when you're giving a lethal injection. And there's also a difference in the cause of death, that when you take away a respirator, if there's nothing wrong with the person doesn't die. Sometimes even if there is something wrong with them, they don't die. Like Karen Ann Quinlan went on for 10 years after they withdrew the respirator thinking she would die. But when you give a lethal injection, the person doesn't die a natural death. They die from the drug that you inject into them. And that is different. So what the argument there is, that the primary intention is different. You're taking reasonable steps to relieve suffering and treating the suffering, and the cause of death is different. In one, it's a natural death. In the other one, it's an inflicted death. And I think that it's very, very important that we keep those distinctions. Sometimes they're not always easy to argue about. One of the arguments of the pro-euthanasia people is, well, how can you tell what the doctor's intention was? Well, one answer to that is that courts decide every day in ruling on criminal culpability what the intention of an accused was. If you drive your car down the street and you're not negligent and you hit and kill somebody, you are not criminally liable. You do exactly the same act, meaning to kill that person. That's first-degree murder. And the difference is you have to judge from all of the circumstances what that intention was. And you can usually tell that with palliative care. If you look at the nature of the person's suffering and circumstances, you look at the appropriateness of the treatment that was used, and if they are appropriate for relieving that suffering, the intention is to relieve suffering. But if somebody's given a drug that's got no use in relieving suffering, and if they give it in a dose that is totally inappropriate, well, then you know that they had the intention to kill the person. One of the sort of slogans that I've developed in this context is that we must kill the pain and suffering, but not kill the patient with the pain and suffering. It's fine to kill the pain and suffering, but not the patient. One of the areas where this comes up is that there's no difference between what is called terminal sedation, where you use a complete sedation with the intention that the person should die without becoming conscious, and palliative sedation, where in fairly rare cases you've got a form of pain, for example, intense neuropathic pain, that you can only manage with some form of sedation. And again, depending on how it's used, you can tell which one is being used. But the danger in this is that sedation can be used as a form of what we're starting to call slow euthanasia. And in England, they introduced what they called the Liverpool Care Pathway. And that was really a protocol where they deeply sedated, mainly old people, put them in a corner of a ward. Nobody went near them until they died, which was usually about 2 weeks. And they usually died from dehydration and starvation. Anyway, the Panorama TV program did a program on this. And there was just outrage about it. And it got into the House of Lords, and now there's an order in Britain that this is not allowed to be used. And you might have seen in the news in the last day or so that France has just debated whether to allow withdrawal of hydration and nutrition for the purposes of inflicting death, and France has decided no, that will not be allowed. And we had a case in the Supreme Court of Canada where a man was deeply unconscious and the hospital and doctors wanted to withdraw all hydration and nutrition, and the family said no. In fact, his wife was a physician, and she was saying no. And the court held that the family had the right to decide, and if they wouldn't agree with it, then you couldn't do that. So it's a very, you know, tricky area. Also, I think noteworthy in the English case was that in some of the hospitals, at least, or at least in some of the circumstances, the hospitals were actually being paid by a bonus by the National Health Service for the more people that died in this manner. So, you know, pretty sort of, I mean, absolutely horrific. And I just got an email today that this is particularly relevant to people with disabilities because they're frightened that they're going to fit within these criteria. And I just received this email today to say that they've launched a strong protest, public protest in Canada to make the case against allowing this. And the Supreme Court accepted this idea that euthanasia was no different from any other medical treatments. And a colleague of mine and I, he's a physician, we've written an article saying that euthanasia is not medical treatment and that it should not be regarded as such. Also, another no difference argument that the court accepted was that if suicide is not a crime, then why should assisting suicide be prohibited? Because it shouldn't be prohibited to assist a legal act. Well, the answer to that is that in all of our common law jurisdictions that have made suicide not a crime, they did it in order to try to prevent suicide, that is to try to save life, not to take life. And the reason was that people were scared to go to physicians because they thought they would be labelled as criminal. And so I think that's an important argument to be able to respond to. Now, just a little bit more, this is strategy four, which is euphemizing euthanasia by calling it medical treatment. And actually, in Canada, the word euthanasia and assisted suicide are not being used. Because the surveys have shown that when you use the word euthanasia or assisted suicide, many more people will not agree with it. So the euthanasia lobby never uses those words now. And in the Quebec Act, in the English version, it's called medically assisted death, for which the acronym is MAD, M-A-D. And so I've had a bit of a campaign using that. And what my colleague and I, he's an expert on the concept of healing. And what we looked at the history of medicine, how this had never been considered medical treatment, how the Hippocratic Oath, which is almost 2,500 years old, had prohibited it, and that it's irreconcilable with medicine's mandate to heal. And there's a distinction between healing and curing. And the idea is, and I'm sure that your Dean of Medicine would be able to tell you much more about this than I can, but the idea is that people can have a feeling of integrity and wholeness and that they can die healed, although you can't cure them. And that's a very different approach to seeing what you need to do for people who are dying. And also it's true that physicians are one of the most opposed groups to euthanasia. One of my arguments was that whoever legalizes euthanasia should be prepared to carry it out. So that as a bit of a tongue-in-cheek suggestion, I thought that we should train the 9 judges of the Supreme Court of Canada to give lethal injections. But on the other hand, one way to keep it out of medicine is by having a special profession that my colleague and I suggested should be called thanatologists, a group of people who would specialise in death. And who they should be, and this was not our original idea, it was from a serious article in Perspectives in Biology and Medicine, which is a very prestigious journal out of the University of Chicago. They said, well, who can understand the law best and who can apply it most strictly. And because this is such a serious matter, that's the people you need. And they suggested a specially trained group of lawyers. And I gave a speech to the Australian Medical Association, this is quite a while ago, and one of the physicians in the audience who was pro-euthanasia jumped to his feet when I said, we can't have physicians killing people. And he said, Margot, please don't use that word killing. It's not killing, it's VAE. And I asked him what that was and said, oh, voluntary act of euthanasia. But when I got to the bit about lawyers were going to be the guys giving the lethal injections, the same physician leapt to his feet and screamed at me across the audience, about 600 people there. He said, Margot, are you crazy? He said, you'd have lawyers killing people? So when it was doctors, it wasn't killing. When it was lawyers, it was. And there's some interesting statistics on this. For example, 63% of the Dutch public would agree with euthanasia for people with dementia, which means they can't consent for themselves. But only 6% of physicians said they would do euthanasia on someone with dementia. Also, we know that medicine, the doctors in the Netherlands are more and more reluctant to use this, and we're not sure why, but it's possibly that they're suffering post-traumatic stress syndrome as a result of carrying out euthanasia. And the Dutch government was concerned that people who wanted euthanasia couldn't get it because the physicians wouldn't do it. So they've set up, I can't remember, it's 5 or 6 what are called mobile euthanasia units, and their ambulances equipped with a physician and a technician and a nurse, and they will go to people's homes. So those are some of the things that are happening. With respect to euphemizing euthanasia, calling it nice, friendly, warm, cuddly things, there's also some very interesting new work in ethics and neuroscience coming out that shows that, and I've been arguing this for a long time, but have never had the scientific evidence to back it up, but what it shows is that our emotions and our moral intuitions inform us about what is and is not ethical. And we're not always conscious that that's happening. But you see, that means that when you call euthanasia something nice, people, their emotions and their moral intuitions don't warn them. And so I think we've got to, and that's another thing I think you've got to do, that you've got to really insist on this is euthanasia and assisted suicide and it's intentional killing of people. So, and this is more or less what I've just been talking about, but this is slightly another aspect of it, that associating euthanasia with medicine sanitizes it. People think of doctors as being ethical, not doing bad things. They think medical treatment is meant to help people. So you get all of that coming in. And we call this taking the white coat off euthanasia, and that's why we suggested having this special profession. We know that there's a phenomenon called therapeutic misconception. And what that is there's been some research done that when a clinical researcher goes to a patient and carefully explains to them that this is not of no benefit to you if you consent to participate in this research, absolutely no benefit. And they do it without a white coat on, and then they do it with a white coat on, then the guys who get the white coat doctors, afterwards they'll say things to the person, to the researcher, like, oh, I'm sure I feel better, you know, it really did me a lot of good. And what it is they associate that white coat and doctors with not doing things to you that are not intended to do good. So you have to take that off. Another thing that my colleague and I did, and again, you know, we've been in a bit of hot water over this, We looked at how would you teach medical students this. And in fact, a week ago I got an email from a medical school where I'm also on the staff, and it said, have you thought yet about how we're going to teach our students to do euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. I mean, the thought of it absolutely horrifies me. But my colleague was a dean of students in the medical faculty, so he's very interested in medical education. In fact, he's a very senior expert in that. So we looked around for a model that we could use to design something to teach how to do this. And what we took was the British Hangman's Bible from the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. And the British didn't want messed up hangings because that was really nasty. So hangmen had to do a course. They had to sit an exam and they had to do a practical examination to show they were qualified. So we took this and we modified it to say, well, this is what you'd need if you're going to have euthanasia. And what we hoped, and so to some extent this works, that when you give people these sorts of examples, they suddenly have a different concept, a different vision, perspective of what is actually involved here. Okay, now this is another one, and this one is tough. What the proponents of euthanasia do is, if they can't think of anything else and you oppose it, they label you religious and dismiss you and your arguments on that basis, and they say that religion has got no place in the public square or in formulation of law or public policy. And in the Quebec report on which the Quebec Act was based, it actually expressly said, we used to be a religious society, but Quebec is not that anymore, and therefore we can't use values such as sacredness of life, because that's a religious value and that doesn't count. You can't think that you can apply that in a society like ours. So there's another little hint there. Do not use the term sacredness or sanctity of life. Do not use it. It is instantly associated with religion and you'll get dismissed on that basis. Use respect for life and argue that all societies in which reasonable people would want to live have respect for life. Moreover, it's very important to argue respect for life at two levels. At the level of the individual person, every individual's life must be respected. But even if you concede that somebody who consents to euthanasia knows what it's all about, that's not a breach of their respect for life. I think it is, but even if you concede that it's not, which is what the pro-euthanasia argue, then you are still seriously breaching respect for life at the societal level. And respect for life has to operate at both levels. And sort of paradoxically, in a way, in a secular society, the two institutions that carry the value of respect for life for society as a whole are medicine, which says we do not kill, and law, which says if you do intentionally kill, you will be punished, prosecuted and punished. So in a secular society, it's even more important not to have legalized killing. And so that's one of the other things. I never, ever, ever argue from a religious base, although my opponents in Canada, I have a fairly exciting life. Somebody said to me that, you know, it's a bit James Bond-like. I've had to have kidnap-proof cars when I was getting a major degree, and they thought that the people who disagreed with my views might try and kidnap me so that the university couldn't confer the degree. And I have security. I have all sorts of exciting things. But one of the things that on this religious base is that I'm often accused of being a secret spy for the Vatican. So I sort of think that's rather nice, actually. Anyway, this is strategy number 7. A few weeks ago, I was doing a CBC Sunday night panel, which is a nationwide thing on the television, and I had two guys against me, both of whom were very pro-euthanasia. One of them's a well-known columnist and broadcaster, a guy called John Moore, and he came on with this whole thing that... I've had a terrible time in the last 6 months. There's been two deaths in my family. One of them was a good death and one of them was a horrible death. My dog had a good death. He went to the vet and got an injection. My mother had a horrible death. Why couldn't my mother have had a good death like my dog? Well, the answer is your mother's not a dog. And if you think that there's a difference between humans and other animals, which I do, although Peter Singer doesn't, as you probably know, then you don't necessarily do to humans what you do to animals. Which is not to say that it's extremely important of not having cruelty to animals and giving them a good life, and I'm an animal nut, but it's still not the same as humans. But I was asked by one of the newspapers that I write for to write a column of what is currently the world's most dangerous idea. And the column I wrote is on the idea that there's no relevant difference between humans and animals. And out of this comes things like, well, if you can't relate to other people, if you're not conscious of your own being, if you can't have a sense of your history and a projection into a future, then you don't have the capacity to have human dignity, therefore you don't have the protections that human dignity brings, which is one of the very important ones, is respect for life, and therefore you can be given a lethal injection. So that's that train of argument. Now this is a new one, and this was accepted by the Supreme Court of Canada and by the trial judge, and it's by a Canadian philosopher, somebody I've also had public arguments with on television, called Wayne Sumner. And he's got this no deprivation theory. And what it is, that dying is only bad if you're deprived of future life that will be good. So if you've got, for example, a disability or you're suffering or whatever it is, then you're better off. I mean, it's a better off dead and a life not worth living approach. And that is a very serious acceptance. So there's a big passage in the judgment for any of you who want to have a look at it, but I think it's a very important argument. It's a quality of life approach with a different name, and it accepts that there's a quality below which life is not worth living. Now, very briefly, because I'm probably going on too long, although you see I had some interruptions, so that gives me a few extra seconds. Analysis of these strategies. So, what does it tell us that we call support for euthanasia a progressive value? Well, it tells us that individual autonomy takes priority over other values. It tells us that it's a situation of seeking control. Choice gives the illusion of control. It's a questioning of authority. The progressive values do not like authority. And that links into, often there's hostility to religion and its values, because religion is seen as being paternalistic and authoritarian. And it's part of the larger culture wars in which these progressive values issues are being fought out. And that is actually the subtitle of my forthcoming book, Bird on an Ethics Wire. The subtitle is Battles About Values in the Culture Wars. Where the Bird on an Ethics Wire comes from is from a cartoon, which is a telephone wire strung between two telephone poles, and there's a huge line of birds on it, and they're all looking at you. But one bird has got his back to you and he's looking the opposite way and his tail is down, and the bird next to him says, "Can't we talk about it?" And that's, I think that I'm very often feel like that bird, that I'm looking the opposite way and talking the opposite of what everybody else seems to be talking about. By the way, Leonard Cohen's agents refused me permission to quote Leonard Cohen in my book because, you know, he has a song, Bird on a Wire, and I wanted to quote it and they wouldn't let me. They were going to sue me if I did. So, you know, I'm not somebody to be associated with. And... So what can we learn from history? And I love John Ralston's source term for history. He doesn't call it history. He calls it human memory. And just at the, in the conclusion, I want to read you a short passage that will tell us something about history. We know that the Hippocratic Oath, I've mentioned it, there's a loss of trust in physicians if they kill, and there's a huge danger of the search for a perfect society or a perfect person through technoscience. And again, you've got these other values there. We have to consider, and this is very important for you, you must get the debate off only the individual level. The individual level is important and we have to take it into account, but we've got to look at what will this do to institutions, medicine and law, what will it do to the society, how do you think your great-great-grandchildren will die if we legalise this, and what will it do at the global level because we are now so interconnected. And you've got to look at the impact not just in the present but in the future. And I've recently been working with this concept that I've been developing, and I find that some of the younger progressive values people can relate to this. And it's to say, look, and even the Pope has now said, we can say, look, we know now that what we can do to our physical ecosystem can irreversibly destroy it. And we've got obligations not to do that and to leave a physical ecosystem that that future people would want to live in. Well, we've got a metaphysical ecosystem. It's the values, attitudes, principles, beliefs, and it's the stories that we share with each other. And those stories focus, particularly in terms of creation of shared values, around the two great events in every human life. That is birth and death. And so we're recreating those stories, and I think we're going in a very wrong direction with regard to both of them. When I was being introduced, it was mentioned that I was at this Beings conference in Atlanta a few weeks ago. And what that is about is redesigning human evolution. We've now got what's called CRISPR technology, where we can snip out genes and put in genes into the germline. That is the genes that are passed on from generation to generation. And we've had more or less a consensus among everybody that this should never be done, that we have to hold this in trust for future generations. Now the Chinese did four cases on, they said they were non-viable human embryos in April, and they've just been able to snip out the genes for Parkinson's disease from two baby pigs. And what we were looking at in Atlanta was, would it be okay to do this in humans? And Steven Pinker, who's a very famous experimental psychologist at Harvard, and he and I were two of the sort of main speakers, and we got into a knockdown, drag-out battle because Pinker said, as far as he was concerned, that if bioethics would get in the way of this, we should get rid of all bioethicists. So, and I was arguing with him that, you know, this was not on. Anyway, you have to consider those other levels. The other thing is, and this was a problem in the Canadian case, that euthanasia unavoidably opens up slippery slopes. There's been a new article published in the last week or so by a friend and colleague of mine called Raphael Cohen-Almagor, who's from Israel, but he's in England at the moment, and he did a study on Belgium, and his conclusion was that 1 in 60 cases of euthanasia in Belgium are done without the person's knowledge that they're being euthanized. And we had a Canadian research group look at Belgium as well, and what they found was that 32% of physicians who'd carried out euthanasia had done so outside the law, the legal provisions. So we know that that's the practical slippery slope. We know there's abuse, and we know that there's this logical slippery slope, is that once you allow this, you can't stop it expanding. You might know that there's a very prominent case at the moment in the Netherlands where a 24-year-old severely depressed young woman who in an interview I read this morning said she'd been wishing since she was in kindergarten that she could be killed, that she could die. And they're going to euthanize her. The psychiatrists have given permission to euthanize her this summer. And so it's really, really, really upsetting. And this is open to discussion. I think we probably do need to talk about whether euthanasia is right or wrong, but the discussion is very utilitarian. What are its risks, harms, and benefits? And that's because the moral relativists don't believe that anything is inherently wrong. And so it's actually a judgment call whether you do more harm than good by saying, well, this is inherently wrong and that's why we shouldn't do it. Or whether you're better off trying to argue it just on a utilitarian base. So in conclusion, euthanasia is not just an incremental expansion of current ethically and legally accepted end-of-life decisions, such as refusals of life support treatment, as pro-euthanasia advocates argue. Acting with an intention to kill is different in kind from allowing a natural death. Euthanasia is not medical treatment. Defining it as such presents serious dangers to patients, the trust-based physician-patient relationship, medicine, and society. If euthanasia is legalized by society, we must take the medical cloak off it and have some specially trained persons other than physicians mandated to administer it. We need to ask, if euthanasia is permitted, how do we think our great-grandchildren will die? What kind of a society will we have left to them? Will it be one in which no reasonable person would want to live? It seems that most politicians and many people in Western democracies, such as Canada and Australia, do not recognise the momentousness of a decision to legalise euthanasia. It's not an incremental change, but a radical and massive shift in our societies and civilizations' foundational values. A prominent Australian politician who argued for legalising euthanasia captured the trivialisation of death that informed support for euthanasia in these words. He said, "As far as I'm concerned, when you're past your use-by or best-before date, you should be checked out as quickly, cheaply, and efficiently as possible. But we're not products to be checked out of the supermarket of life. And what would be the cumulative effect of the use of euthanasia on vulnerable people? Consider, for instance, that Belgium is currently looking at allowing euthanasia of people with Alzheimer's disease. What would be the impact of that on the shared values that bond us as a society and in setting the ethical tone of our society? It's wisely said that we can't judge the ethical tone of a society by how it treats its strongest, most privileged, most powerful members, but by how it treats its weakest, most vulnerable, and most in need citizens. Dying people belong in that latter group." And now, if I just may have 2 minutes to read something to you, because I, when I first read it, which was only very recently, I thought this was absolutely chilling. So, citing the Nazis as a relevant example for consideration in today's euthanasia debates is decried by pro-euthanasia advocates as totally irrelevant and unfounded fear-mongering, and is avoided by those who are anti-euthanasia for fear of providing an easy target that could be used to weaken their case and dismiss their voice in the public debate. But an article in the New York Times of the 8th of October, 1933, entitled "Nazis Plan to Kill Incurables to End Pain, German Religious Groups Oppose Move," written by the Associated Press, resonates so clearly with rhetoric and arguments in our contemporary debates and contains such powerful warnings, and in retrospect provides such a chilling example of where legalising euthanasia can lead. Here it is. Berlin, October the 7th. The Ministry of Justice, in a detailed memorandum explaining the Nazi aims regarding the German Penal Code, today announced its intention to authorize physicians to end the sufferings of incurable patients. The memorandum, still lacking the force of law, proposed that, quote, it shall be made possible for physicians to end the tortures of incurable patients upon request in the interests of true humanity, close quotes. This proposed legal recognition of euthanasia, the act of providing a painless and peaceful death, raised a number of fundamental problems of a religious, scientific, and legal nature. The Catholic newspaper Germania hastened to observe, quote, the Catholic faith binds the conscience of its followers not to accept this method of shortening the suffering of incurables who are tormented by pain. In Lutheran circles too, life is regarded as something that only God alone can take. A large section of the German people, it was expected in some interested circles, might ignore the provisions for euthanasia, which overnight has become a widely discussed word in the Reich. In medical circles, the question was raised as to just when is a man incurable and when should his life be ended. According to the present plans of the Ministry of Justice, incurability would be determined not only by the attending physician, but also by two official doctors who would carefully trace the history of the case and personally examine the patient. In insisting that euthanasia shall be permissible only if the accredited attending physician is backed by two experts who so advise, the ministry believes a guarantee is given that no life still valuable to the state will be wantonly destroyed. The legal question of who may request the application of euthanasia has not been definitely solved. The ministry merely has proposed that either the patient himself shall expressly and earnestly ask for it, or in the case that the patient is no longer able to express his desire, his nearer relatives, acting from motives that do not contravene morals, shall so request. It echoes exactly what's talked about in Canada. Thank you.
That was a talk from Professor Margaret Somerville. For more information, visit nd.edu.au. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.